So in our journey through the Bible, last week, we looked at the rise of Israel, the zenith almost, the time that was greatest in the life and history of God's people. They'd been rescued from slavery. They'd eventually entered the promised land. They had an experience of judges, some good, not so good. And then they were given a king. A king, King David, who rose from this small shepherd boy to kill Goliath and to become their greatest king. How the mighty have fallen. This week we look at the fall of David. And as we look at his experience, we see what is really in the human heart. Very much helped by the thoughts of a great contemporary preacher, Tim Keller, who is based in the center of Manhattan, who writes about this passage, saying that it tells us three things. It tells us about the power of sin, about the shrewdness of grace, and about the assurance of pardon. Sin is very powerful. David at home sees this beautiful woman, Bathsheba, invites her to his palace and sleeps with her. And in order to try and cover up what has happened, because she conceives a child, he draws her husband back from war and hopes that he will encourage her husband to go home and to sleep with his wife, and therefore to confuse the scenario that he himself has set up. But Uriah, man of principle, refuses to go home, only choosing to sleep outside his house, saying that all of his soldiers are still on the battlefield. Why should he experience such comforts with his wife? And so David compounds his sin of adultery by conspiring to have Uriah murdered. And let's not forget who Uriah was. He was a member of the so-called mighty men that we learn about early in David's past. They risked their lives to save David. They were his bodyguard, if you like to think of it, in all of those days, weeks, and months when Saul was seeking to kill him. He is a man, Uriah, to whom David literally owes his life. And yet here we see in this one chapter, nearly half the Ten Commandments that we looked at a few weeks ago, broken in one awful enterprise. And yet too, we also see that these laws are broken by a man who wrote in Psalm 40, verse 8, "I desire to do your will, O Lord. Your law is within my heart." He must have written those words, meaning them, surely. And yet he did this. So what does it teach us? Well, I think it teaches us a very important and countercultural lesson. That the seeds of the worst deeds live in the best people. But of course, this is countercultural, isn't it? Because the world in which we live says that ultimately we are all good. The leaders of the Allied nations didn't believe the Holocaust reports in World War II at the beginning until it was too late, including FDR, Roosevelt. He could not accept it. He said, "How could a civilization which produced Mozart behave like this?" A philosopher who was an atheist before the Second World War, C.E.M. Jode, came to faith after that war, saying this: "The view of evil that believes that it is the byproduct of circumstances is now understood to be intolerably shallow." he came to the realization in his own life and faith that none of us ultimately is good, that all of us is capable of evil. What the Bible describes as the doctrine of original sin. But do we believe this ourselves? We are Christian people. Are we capable of such things? We'll just look back over the people that we've encountered since we began this journey through the Bible. Abraham, great man of God, a call upon his life, repeatedly told lies. Jacob, a great schemer. Moses, drawn out to lead God's people, kills a man. Peter, one of Jesus' closest friends, curses and denies God. And then we meet David today. Do we really think we're any better than them? Can you look at this story and say, I could never do that? Well, if you say that, you are making a step towards it. Because the Bible teaches us that the seed lies in all our hearts. And a seed is a very tiny thing, isn't it? Like the seeds that were planted, or the saplings that were planted in our churchyard outside. If we believe we're not capable of these things, it makes us more capable of them. So look at your life as I look at my life. Do I see any self-pity, any resentment, any hurt, pride? What can these feelings become if they fall into the right soil? But of course, we think these are just little things. We believe in our heads that Jesus Christ loves us. But sometimes in practice, our self-image is based more on being better than other people than being unconditionally loved by God. I'm better than others. So we screen out the reality of what these seeds are capable of. We are capable of the worst things possible. This is the power of sin. An 18th century Christian theologian, Jonathan Edwards, said this: be killing sin, or sin will be killing you. Of course, it's far easier to squash a little sapling in the ground or to pick up a seed out of the ground than to bring down a huge tree. Now, the Bible, the list I've given you a few minutes ago, includes a load of rogues, doesn't it? God consistently, however, works with those rogues. He gives his grace to ordinary people who don't deserve it or seek it, or even appreciate it. And this is why the Bible is not about a book of how we can do better. Try harder and you'll do a little better. No, it's not a self-help book. Because demonstrably it doesn't work. No, it's a book that shows us the grace of God working in ordinary people, consistently pouring himself out. So that's the power of sin. Secondly, the shrewdness of grace. Nathan comes very shrewdly to challenge David. And this story is told against the backdrop of the importance of hospitality and care for the outsider. So Nathan tells this story about a wealthy man and a poor man. And the wealthy man comes, and someone comes for hospitality to his house, and he takes from the poor man to give to the visitor. Outrageous thing to do. And David's response is twofold. He says specifically, yes, in verse 4, he must pay back for that lamb four times over, which was exactly what it said in the Mosaic law, the law of Moses. Pay back if you steal something. But then it goes completely overboard. He says this man deserves to die. Have you ever noticed that? You think, well, that's a bit extreme. He took a lamb. Well, actually, the Mosaic law did not provide for people to have to die if they did that. They said you must pay back four times. So why was David getting so exercised about this? Why was he so furious? Well, Nathan is counting on the obverse side of a guilty conscience. I think it's true that if you are feeling guilty inside and trying to cover it up, and I'm sure David was feeling very guilty inside at this time because he committed adultery and murder and lied, he would try to compensate it by being an even greater champion of justice. It was really the semi-conscious eruption of his own guilt when he heard this story. So he says, who is this man? Does he think there is no justice in my kingdom? And Nathan says to him those famous words, you are the man. This is not the introduction, but the conclusion. Why didn't Nathan burst into David with a challenge? He was a prophet, after all. He knew exactly what had happened. God had told him. Why didn't he just burst into David's throne room and say, you are a liar and adulterer and a murderer? Was he afraid of David? I don't think so. Prophets tended to be made of pretty stern stuff in those days. No. Nathan was following God's wisdom, which always wants someone to be convicted and to be transformed, not condemned. Now, those in leadership, like David, are very susceptible to self-pity. And if you have ever been in a position of leadership, I think you'll know what I'm talking about. Because the pressure and the isolation of being a leader at times, and the unfair criticism, is very hard to bear. And it's in those times that people who are leaders often fall prey to self-pity. So you see someone bathing on a roof. Anybody been watching the Jeremy Thorpe series, the Very English Scandal? I mean, fascinating. I mean, obviously it's a storified version of what we really don't know completely went on. But the most extreme conversation that's had there, you know, in his room in Parliament, we say, we are going to kill that man, Nicholas Scott. Why? For the benefit of the party. Because otherwise it will bring me down and it will destroy the party. So two men conspire to murder. Those in leadership are very susceptible. And God goes for conviction and transformation rather than condemnation, if there is ever any hope of conviction. So grace is very shrewd. What's the application for us? We all need to be Nathans. We need to have the gumption at times to challenge the friends who we know who might have character flaws. It's not a very PC thing to do, is it? But if we see someone consistently behaving in a way that we know is destructive to them and other people, are we going to have the guts to challenge them about that behavior? We need to do it with love, of course. But we also need Nathans in our lives. Hebrews chapter 3 verse 13 says this, encourage one another daily as long as it is called today, so that none of you may be hardened by sin's deceitfulness. Now this can't happen on WhatsApp or Facebook. It has to be face to face. Sadly, so much of the time people just splurt out criticism of others electronically, and that just doesn't do anything. It makes it worse. So sin is powerful, grace is shrewd, and pardon is assured, the last point. Go away from here and read Psalm 51, will you? There isn't time to look at it now, but that is the overflowing outpouring of David's repentance in relation to this deed. For now, just look at verse 13 with me, if you will. David said to Nathan, "I have sinned against the Lord." And Nathan replies, "The Lord has taken away your sin. You're not going to die." David had committed more than just adultery and murder. He'd abused his position. He was the king. He was supposed to stop all these things from happening. How on earth could God forgive this? Well, Eugene Peterson, a Christian theologian, says this: there's a remarkable resonance between this encounter and Jesus' encounter with Pilate. Both happen in a courtroom. Nathan says to David, "You are the man." Pilate says to Jesus, "Behold the man." In both courtrooms, things are topsy-turvy. In 2 Samuel, David, who's the man on the judgment seat on the throne, is the man who should be in the dock. In Pilate's courtroom, Jesus, the man who is accused, should be on the judgment seat. In 2 Samuel, Nathan sets things right. He challenges David to come down off the judgment seat and to be judged himself. But in Pilate's courtroom, no one turns up to put things right. No prophet turns up to challenge Pilate. And on the cross, Jesus is all alone. Why? Because in the dock, where you and I should be for the things that we've done wrong, Jesus took the punishment that we should take. So be killing sin so it doesn't kill you. Be a Nathan and get some Nathans for yourself. And it doesn't matter who you are or what you've done. Repent and be forgiven.